Blog Talk Radio.
This is Drew Doc Webb from Dr. Snake Oil, and I would like to introduce you to The Inside Scoop by Spitfire. We discuss anything and everything motorcycle. Now here's your host, Vicky Sanfilippo, a.k.a. Spitfire.
This is Spitfire right here. I know you couldn't tell. Yeah, good afternoon, everybody. It is November 17th, 2015, and today is a really special day because we are having our first live ever accident scene management summit where we are talking about motorcycle trauma. We're doing that. We're reviewing a curriculum. We're looking at what is best for motorcyclists. How can we improve our program? How can we get more people trained? And if you don't know what the heck I'm talking about, you better stay tuned so you can figure it out. So we're doing a special live one-hour program here, and I'm here with six other accident scene management instructors. We're going to be talking to you a little bit more about that, but I just have one news item that I wanted to talk about this week. New motorcycle news is a little bit slow other than some new products that are coming out, but there is still that nagging issue that just keeps coming up every week with motorcycle profiling and the issues that are surrounding that. Waco, Texas, the issue that happened in May, it really sparked off a lot of issues with motorcyclists being profiled, being told no, that they can't come into places because they're, you know, no colors and you know, motorcyclists are nothing but trouble. And we should all be concerned about that. We should be concerned when people tell us, no, you cannot conceal carry, which is a legal activity. Only the motorcyclist cannot conceal carry, by the way. You know, when you go to attend an event that you've been invited to, this happened in Milwaukee this last week when the USS Milwaukee was being commissioned by the Navy into service, and they wanted the motorcyclists to come down with their flags, all patriotic and everything. But by the way, we want you to leave your guns at home, you know, because we don't want no trouble. And I'm like, what trouble? Are you kidding me? You know, yes, motorcyclists are veterans, you know, and I feel a lot safer when they're there looking after me. So I don't know why it would be different than the general public. So we are going to be having another one-hour special on December 1st, and Double D from the Motorcycle Profiling Project is going to be our special guest that day. And we're really looking forward to having a live discussion that day. We're going to be taking call-ins. And I've already got somebody who's asking a question here, so Dobie, I'm going to get to your question in a little bit. But we're really excited about all the things that we can contribute, but concerned at the same time about what's happening. So I want to let any callers who are calling in today know that if you press the 1 on your keypad, I will know that you want to ask a question, and I can put you live. The other way that you can ask a question is by going to Facebook and type your question into our Facebook event. I'll be watching Facebook as we talk. But, you know, with all that stuff, I'm thinking, blah, 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 you know. Let's get some other people talking here. Come on, let's hear a little noise here in the background. Oh, yeah, see, this, you know, bikers, crazy people, making carry and everything. But, what we're doing here is just so exciting for those of us who feel passionate about it. And we've got people here from all over the country, so I'm going to pass my phone around because I think you're going to be able to hear them better and have them tell you who they are and where they're from.
All right. Michelle Anzinza from North Texas, instructor trainer for ASM.
And I'm Alan Cruitt, and I'm here from the state of Envy. That's Nevada.
And I'm Teresa McClellan, instructor trainer from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, I'm Tony Michaelis, and I'm a lead instructor from Boise, Idaho.
Somewhere around there. Aloha. I'll guess where I'm from. Hey, this is Terry Bond, and C.S. Berlin, instructor trainer of Pine Island. Thanks for joining in.
I'm Debbie Perinello from Michigan, and I'm an instructor trainer.
Hey, I'm Roxanne Heisinger, California lead instructor.
All right. We have people from all over. Isn't that great? You know, and as a lot of you know, but maybe not everybody, because I've been doing this radio show for a while and haven't really revealed who I truly am. I'm the Access Pain Management founder and director and an instructor trainer, and started doing that back in 1996. And our program has grown since then. Realized after a couple of years that there were 18 million motorcycles in the United States and this could not be done alone. I started meeting some really cool people with a lot to offer, to be able to teach motorcyclists how they can help each other. The most likely person to be first at the scene of a motorcycle crash is another motorcyclist. We often travel in groups, or we travel on roads that are really beloved by motorcyclists, so it makes sense that we as a group care enough about our brothers and sisters, which we oftentimes call each other, our brothers and sisters, that we want to be there to take care of those folks. And it's really important for us to take that seriously. I mean, we can do all kinds of things to try to prevent crashes from happening in the first place, and I'm all about that. I don't ever want to crash. It must hurt a lot, and I don't want to do that. So, Roxy, can you tell us anything about how much it hurts?
Charlie Davidson don't like being stand riders.
I know you used to race, so you're a pro at falling down, and you can't race without crashing a motorcycle. So how many broken bones have you had?
I broke my ankle, but pretty much just a few concussions, and that's it.
Lucky. I've seen your suit. I have seen the torture that your race suit went through. So you've had a little experience of crashing, right?
For sure. Yeah. I did a pothole, and it took me out, and I lost my bike. Cracked the A-frame and had to recover from the fractures in my back. You bet.
Alan, what about you? You ever go down?
They teach motorcycle safety, and we don't teach crashing.
Oh, you guys cool? Yeah. So, you know, motorcyclists, you know, we've got a few war stories to tell, but it rarely does that stop us. I mean, we always want to get back out there and enjoy what we love, and we want everybody to be able to do that. But we really believe we can make a big difference in how we react and how we can fill that space, that time from when you call 911 until the ambulance gets there. Can't tell you how many people I've asked that have never been trained, what would you do? And they always laugh and say, I'd call 911. And then they stop laughing when I say, but then what? And then what? And they've really not thought about that, you know, and there's 5 to 55 minutes if you are in there are some remote areas in the United States that can take almost an hour for the EMS to get to you. So, you know, what are you going to do during that time? And there's a lot you can. So now we're here in Lake Tahoe area, which not exactly Lake Tahoe, but like about 2-3 minutes away from the lake, which is good enough for me. And one of our instructors from California, Roxy, her family has a beautiful cabin that they offered to us so that we could really kind of, you know, keep focused and work this out, you know, work our program out. And I'm just going to, because Michelle and some of the other, and Teresa and some of the other people have been here for the last 3 hours when we've really had to, you know, we've put about 3-4 solid hours into getting started on this. We're going to be here for a couple more days. But, you know, tell me a little bit about what you're finding as we're looking into this. I'm going to pass this around. So.
Well, I think, of course, with anything, healthcare is changing all the time. So first aid stuff is getting to where it needs to be consistent and everyone needs to be on the same page. And I think as bystanders, that we can get this across to them with our curriculum. And I think we're thinking just about the trends of even going more online with some of our stuff. And I think that's kind of a really neat way to go at this point.
So, Teresa, what are you seeing?
What I'm seeing is it's interesting, you know, as nurses and healthcare providers, we look at evidence-based practice. So it's interesting to see that ASHI, American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, as well as, you know, pre-hospital like PHTLS, ITLS, and trauma score course, everything is focusing more on best practice, and it's interesting to see the similarities, and it's a good thing that we're, you know, upgrading our curriculum as well to see what's the best practice and care for the trauma patient pre-hospital line.
Talk about the hands-on and how important that is in the classroom.
The hands-on is a skill that you need to know how to do it. Just reading it in a book or watching somebody do it doesn't give you the confidence, doesn't give you the fine points of like doing jaw thrust breathing or how to do log rolls or how to move somebody or if you have to remove a helmet. If you don't, if you haven't had the hands-on, pictures don't always do justice.
Yes, absolutely. And along those lines, this is Cherry Bomb, Mr. Francia. And I was saying absolutely, and along those lines, our writers today are much more informed, really smart people that have a love and passion for writing, but they're not stupid. They know that, we know that things happen, accidents happen. Just because you don't want to think about going down doesn't mean it's not going to happen to you. And even if it's not you, it could be somebody else. It could be your buddy. And there's nothing worse than knowing you want to do something, having a desire to help, and feeling stuck. I've had students in my class that volunteer stories. Something happened to them. They were the witness to an accident 10 years prior, and they still carry it within them. How they would have liked to help. They knew they wanted to help, but they sincerely, truly did not know what to do, and they're still traumatized today. And that's why they finally get it into them to seek out our class, take the class, and always, 100% of the time, I always hear how happy they were that they took the step to do that. And until you really take it to heart, how important it is for you, for your brothers, your sisters, or a whole writing community, and take action on it. Wishing and hoping doesn't do anything. You learn the skills. Know what's up. You know, we're really realistic and learn it.
You know, I think what you're saying is it's all about your sorry yes. I mean, it's all about my sorry yes, in my opinion. You know, because, I mean, we're a lot of us are healthcare professionals that are sitting in this room, you know, and yeah. And we're sitting here thinking, oh my God, who's gonna take care of me? Seriously, if I'm the one who goes down, and you know, the people who are hanging out with me, I want to care enough to want to help me, and if they don't, it kind of makes me wonder, like, you know, who are you that you don't care? Yeah, why am I hanging around with you? Why am I riding with you? You know. So I think it's got a lot to do with that. We've got a statement here on our Facebook page from Ben Martinez from Arizona, and he says, you know, you can teach people all you want not to crash, but in his opinion, that's kind of a dumbass statement because a real writer knows that a crash is going to happen, you know, and you can ignore it and you can pretend it's not going to happen, but, you know, it's kind of like I say, this is our disaster plan. This is when things don't go right and what we plan to do to minimize the effects of what happens. So I think not talking about it is kind of not an option. It's, you know, you can try not to, but, you know, things happen. I mean, you can't control that deer that bolts out of the woods. It's not just about avoiding the crash of another vehicle. There's more to it. So, Debbie, you've done some racing, you know, and, you know, I've always thought that the racing community is a community that really needs this as well.
Absolutely. And actually, I've had a handful of the dirt track riders that have contacted me in regards to teaching the corner workers that are at the tracks because they're real limited on their EMS that they have at the race tracks as well. And so they're actually AMA sanctioned races that they're talking about having us come in and train because the helmet removal is not a big big taught issue, let's say, in EMS, and so they feel more comfortable having someone trained with proper helmet removal.
Yeah, well, you know, helmets is what somebody gets really fixed on with our program. They're like, you know, they want to come and they want to take our class because we teach helmet removal, and they don't always seem to understand that it goes twofold. It's about the helmet, but it's also about knowing what to do when that helmet comes off. And I know of people that will take the helmet removal information, and their group wanted them to go and get this training so they could come back to their group and teach them how to take helmets off. And I don't think they really missed the whole boat, you know. They don't understand what it is that we're explaining. So, if not, who wants to explain this? You know, why? What do you do? How do you make this decision? How do you make a decision about when to take the helmet off and what to do when it comes off?
Right. Well, I think, you know, there are situations where they don't move the injured. Well, you have to know when you need to move the injured. You have to know specifically when to remove a helmet and when not to. We teach that. And we also base what we do here at ASM on research. So that's like why we're doing the summit, too, is to get all the research that's currently updated and follow that. So we're doing all the right stuff. Once you determine that, we have to get this helmet off because we're flying certain criteria, like they're not breathing, we've got to breathe for them, and the helmet is actually being a hindrance, then, you've got to do it, and then you've got to know what to do once you do that.
If that helmet interferes with breathing, which could be like somebody's throwing up inside of their helmet, there are other things that could be interfering with breathing other than that they're not breathing.
Right.
But
they're putting their air with like a strap or something.
That can be that simple, that the strap's so tight.
Yeah. So once we teach you that part of it, then I think it's really important that you have to know the next step. You can't just remove the helmet.
Yeah. So can Teresa, with the trauma nurse, can you tell us about what to do when that helmet comes off? Like, how do you do a special way of opening up an airway?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Once the helmet's removed, we want to make sure that we're opening up an airway by doing the jaw thrust. And you're not jacking that head back like you normally would to check for airway in CPR for rescue breathing. You want to maintain that cervical spine immobilization. So it's a good indication that if you're removing that helmet, that you have your airway stuff there because that helmet's coming off because they have a compromised airway. So there's nothing worse than holding C-spine, getting a helmet off, and realizing your airway stuff is in your saddlebag up on your bike. So it's a good indication that if you come up across any type of crash scene, you're bringing all your stuff over there with you as well. So, maintaining cervical spine mobilization, doing a jaw thrust, using a barrier for rescue breathing is the technique, ensuring that we have an open airway. If they have an occluded airway at that time, maintaining an open airway, if you have to use your bulb syringe or some sort of suction device to get out teeth or secretions or vomit at that time is crucial too, because in trauma, if you don't have an airway, you pretty much lost your patient.
Okay, so if there's anybody, I want to repeat this, I said it right early when we first got started, but if there's anybody who is listening by phone that has a question or would like to join our conversation, I know we've got another instructor probably who's on the line with us right now, so if you'd like to call in join our conversation, hit the 1 key on your phone pad, and that will let me know that you would like to join this conversation. We have another instructor who's trying to get here right now. He's at LaGuardia in Chicago. No, not LaGuardia in Chicago. He's in Chicago right now at the airport. He left LaGuardia this morning. And so he's waiting for his next flight. So we're going to see if we can get Phil Black to join us as well. There are specific things that we teach, and it's not the easiest thing to just teach it in a short period of time. I find people will also say, hey, can you come and talk to our group? And you've got 10 minutes, and we want you to tell them everything they need to know about motorcycle trauma in 10 minutes. And I was just kind of like, I'll take whatever time you give me. I'll tell you the truth. You know, if you say 5 minutes, I'll take 5. If you tell me 10, I'll take 10. If you give me an hour, I'll fill it up for you. But it's really hard to do a proper job of teaching people in a short period of time. I can introduce what we teach and what it's about, but there's so much more that goes into it. Like, for instance, the helmet removal that we teach, to properly teach that, takes about 45 minutes to teach it and let you practice. To show you without letting you try that skill is, almost wasted, because people will find when they get down there, even though we just showed them, they have a hard time until they've done it themselves. And then they understand what we're talking about when we say that when the helmet head comes out of the helmet, it weighs about 8 to 12 pounds, and you could get quite a bobble.
And even though we just told them that and we just showed them how to do it, you'll still see that once they do it, they didn't realize how much that head weighs. It doesn't sound like a lot of weight until you all of a sudden it's in your hand. So, you know, there's just all these really important things that you learn in a classroom and by doing hands-on. The jaw thrust, I mean, it's just not well taught. The majority of people that even have been taught jaw thrust have not been, you know, it's been mentioned to them. Somebody might have kind of shown it to them, but they've never really done it. And they aren't feeling proficient at it, not unless they're a trauma specialist, like a paramedic, you know, like somebody who's in that kind of field. So to teach that to somebody who's never heard of it before, sometimes it's easier for me. I don't know what you guys think. I think it's easier to teach somebody who's never heard of it than somebody who has been doing head tilt chin lifts.
Yeah, or, it's a great good idea.
Yeah, because they've been doing
it.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, put the head down, CPR boy. Put the head down. Yeah, so it's one of those things that, you know, unless you were in a setting where somebody could show you, have you practice that, proctor you through it, you know, those are things that need to be in a classroom. And I don't see our classroom going away. Not at all. That's not what we're here trying to do. We want to know what we can safely put online, which would be easy to put online. We believe that we're going to end up with a program that can still be taught all in classroom if that's what you prefer or that's what your group prefers. That can be done. But we want to see what we can do to make things easier. And I think what we're finding already is that online, the advantage is less. It's that we can give you so much more.
Right. Mm-hmm. Links to other subjects that you can go into more in depth if you'd like to, and other if you don't want to.
Videos and resources.
Yeah, videos.
Yeah, so definitely. I'm guessing that that's going to be a real plus for the people who want to utilize that resource. Switching gears again, because I'm going to do that several times, because we've only got an hour, so I'm going to fit it all in. So we've got Alan here. And Alan has a unique niche here, too. Like, none of the rest of us are rider coaches, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Alan, tell me how you believe this fits in. I mean, you've been passionate about it since you heard about it. You so passionate about it that you not only wanted to become an instructor, but you went through EMT training so that you could be a lead instructor. You were like, just tell me what I got to do, and I can't. And Deb is the same way. She started out, you know, she was like, tell me what I got to do, and I'm like, you have to become an EMT. And she's like, okay. And now she's a paramedic. So anyway, tell me, Alan.
Well, I'm hoping actually to go even farther and be an instructor trainer in the future. I'm working towards that goal. For motorcycle safety instructors, the state of Nevada recognized that those folks were not getting motorcycle first aid specific training. They had a first aid requirement, they had a CPR requirement, but the first aid was your basic go to a Band-Aid first aid class. That's what I want to call it without mentioning names. And it wasn't motorcycle specific. Didn't have anything to do with trauma, didn't have anything to do with the kinds of things that can happen when you're teaching a motorcycle class and a student goes down face first or does a head plant or something like that. So they weren't getting any training that was really motorcycle related. This is an advanced skill set that is motorcycle specific, that it actually exceeds the training you would get if you were doing automobile specific trauma training, but it's all trauma. So it starts with the neck and C-spine stabilization. We were talking about helmet removal and just something as simple as removing a helmet. You could actually undo a strap. The reason you're removing the helmet is because the person's not breathing. You can undo the helmet strap and they can start breathing and you're done. You don't want to move them anymore. I've been the first on the scene to too many motorcycle accidents. And if my victim, my patient could actually move, I was like, oh, cool, I'm not going to move you. If they could move their head, it was like, well, you know, that's not a great idea. You shouldn't be doing that. And just learning what to do. I was one who, the first time I came across a motorcycle accident, ran to help two people who went down face first in Coral in Key West. And when I got there, I looked at them and froze because I had no idea what to do next. I had the right sort of attitude, the right desire, the right wish, But when I got there, I had no skills, and I did not like the way I reacted to the situation. And that's when I swore I was going to get trained and never have to go through that kind of feeling of helplessness again. Since then, and I swear I didn't cause any of these, but I've been first on the scene to so many wrecks, it's ridiculous. And what I find out, which is kind of humorous, is after a person takes this class, they wind up getting involved in a situation where they wind up assisting in a scene. And so now I'm telling my students, so it's not going to be long after this class that you're going to get to use these skills.
Yes, it is a way.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, the other thing that we found, we actually did a study on that. We studied 2,000 of our students back in 2005, I believe it was, and we sent out surveys to 2,000 people who had just taken the class, like within the last 3 years. Some of them had just taken it in November. We're sending out a survey in January. So I'm talking about, you know, a previous three-year sample. We got 846 responses. Is that amazing?
Yeah.
That is a 43% response rate to a mailed-out survey. So that was really good. And of those people who responded, 29% of them had used the information since taking the class. That is nearly one-third.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really very amazing to see the response of people. We found that 78% of people said they rode with more caution and more awareness. That was not something we were expecting, but it was a great outcome. And we found that some of the people that felt that this information helped them in their own crashes, which, is, again, you know, it was like not necessarily what we were after, but we found out that people were more cooperative when they crashed because they knew what to expect. We had one gal who directed her own trauma scene from the ground. She was on her way to Alaska, was traveling by herself. She was hit at an intersection up in Canada by a truck. And from the ground, she was conscious. She told people to go back to her bike and get her trauma pack, told them what she needed out of that trauma pack and what they should do with it. And I thought, you know what, just, I mean, that's an inspiring, wonderful story. So,
Roxy, you got one.
Yeah, I've got a great one. Not too long ago, we were riding outside of San Francisco. I don't know if you guys know San Francisco, but it's a pretty busy place. I mean, 101 is really busy. We had a rider go down, and the pack stopped, and everybody had been through the training, except for maybe three people. We shut down Highway 101, which is amazing, and we shut it down quick. And everybody responded. Everybody was doing the right thing. It was just amazing. So when the police got there, they were amazed. They're like, gosh, we don't even need to be here. And when EMT arrived, all they had to do was pack her up and head out. And it was just the most amazing thing. I was a proud teacher mama. But everybody did. It was just amazing. It was great training.
Well, I think you've heard this, you guys. You've heard this at your classes where when people leave the class, they go, I hope I can remember even one of these things, you know. I hope I can remember what to do if something were to happen. And the stories we've heard have been more like what Roxy's talking about, where people just go into action. It's like they just remember that they need to concentrate on safety first, and that's why we make such a big deal about the safety. And you know, when people come to the class, they aren't expecting that, but they end up spending the first hour and a half in the class learning how to secure a scene and how to, you know, place vehicles and how to direct traffic and how to, you know, handle that situation. You move the person, you leave them there. You know, you have to make some critical decisions very early. And I think that because we make such a big deal about it, it really sticks in people's heads. And they know that if they can at least get things started. You know, people have always asked me, what's the first thing I do if somebody goes down? And they expect me to say something, treatment, you know, control the bleeding, you know. And the first thing is secure the scene, you know. And that's something anybody can do. People are afraid of getting involved in first aid and touching a person and doing that. But don't be afraid. you not doing anything is worse.
This is Alan again. I'm the only man.
Yeah.
I just want to emphasize that hands-on because we, you know, go through a bunch of lecture and talk about how everything works. But I have discovered in these classes that the real learning and the feedback I get from the students is the real learning is when they try it out. That's when all the aha stuff happens. That's when, like Vicki was saying, you realize how heavy a head is when it comes time to support that bowling ball. That's when you realize how difficult it is to actually slide a helmet off a person's head without jostling their neck and their spinal alignment. And that's when they find out all the tricks of the trade, because we make it easy. It's really easy if you position the person properly to do a log roll. But if you try to do it wrong, you're going to hurt yourself. And each of the little subtle things that make these exercises go well is what I think makes it stick with the folks who are concerned about what am I going to remember when the time comes. They've actually done it. And like we said earlier, they've built up the confidence that they could do it again.
Yeah, because you get, I'm sorry, that's myself. But you get those folks that tell you, like, you know, they come to the class and they're like, okay, and they think their strength may be this. Like some people go, yeah, I've been in the EMS world, so I think I can be the person that takes care of them. Or then you get, like, for instance, we had a scene, and it turns out that the gal that you expected that wouldn't be the person to take charge of the scene and kind of help direct everybody and get everybody in the right position, you didn't think that, oh, it's a cheap bird. I mean, get it all and grasp it all and everything. But there she was, the gal that would never be a part of any of that. And all of a sudden she stepped into the plate. She was able to just take everything she had learned and organize the scene and get everything taken care of. And there she was. And it was like, wow, you just never know which what part you're going to, you know, be best at. But when it comes down to it and it happens, all of a sudden things start happening. And you kind of, yeah, it just clicks. And we had, even with Jeff, who also teaches with me, as an instructor, and we all had him. He went down and all, and one of the students is the one that saved his life and knew specifically what to do. And because all the right things were done, Jeff survived. And so, and he wasn't expected to survive for a period of time.
Well, he had a hangman's fracture and all, and had they been turning him over and doing all kinds of things that were not supposed to be done for him. And the student Chris, who I'm talking about, if he hadn't been there, do all the right things for Jeff, he would have been basically a vegetable or dead. So,
yeah,
we're very thankful. And that makes us even more passionate about what we do.
And Jeff, you know, I just got to say, if you're listening, that we are just so happy to see all the things that you are doing now. I'm amazed. You know, when I got that opportunity to give you a big hug last year, I was like, wow, you know, you came to meet me out at Quaker Steak and Lube, and you're walking and talking and all these things, and it was so scary there for a little while. But, you know, what a great life you're able to have now today because, you know, because people were there and they did the right things. It was the teaching that you did for your own group to
right.
save your sorry ass, I'm telling you.
Yeah, I know.
I get a lot of folks who say, you know, I'm a little worried about having these skills because now I might have to be the person who has to dress a wound, or I might have to stabilize a fracture or something like that. And I'm not one of those people who wants to deal with blood. And the point I wanted to make was that there's actually a role for everybody.
Right.
If you've got a group team, you could be the person who calls 911. You could be the person who goes down the road to the last spot where it's appropriate to control traffic. You don't have to be the person who deals with the stuff that makes you queasy. There's a function for everybody, and when there's a team, it's awesome because then everybody can go to work and do their thing, and that's how you work with a team like Roxy was talking about.
Everyone seems to fall into the right place.
That's where you're going to be. And this is Teresa. I just wanted to point out in the advanced class, we talk a little bit about critical incident stress management and debriefing. I think that's important for any skill level, whether you're a bystander or a flight nurse, or a trauma nurse, or medic, any type of crash scene, especially a motorcycle crash scene, if we're riding with our loved ones and our friends, or just, you know, a brother or sister, you see them down and you help, they can be traumatic events at any level. So I think it's really important to incorporate their critical incident stress management and debriefing after every type of accident crash scene. So I've had a lot of rescue rider students and students call me up afterwards and tell me what they did and what they didn't do. And I said, so how was your confidence level? And they said, it was kind of funny because multiple times they said, it's like I had a little Teresa on my shoulder telling me what to do. So it was kind of funny to hear that. So I hope that's in a positive way, you know, that they hear me saying beneficial things to do, you know, not instead of being that nagging person. But make sure that you're reaching out to outside sources to talk about the situation because, you know, critical incident stress management, you can have post-traumatic stress and have nightmares, and not only as a trauma victim, but as the caregiver as well.
All right, so I've got a comment here that I'd like to read to you as soon as I get back to it. I kind of got distracted. Bill is going to be calling in here in just a little bit. But we have somebody from Wisconsin, Ann McGuire, who wrote in and said that what she'd like to know, since we have this group of people together, and where did it go? It's there somewhere. Okay, it'll just take me a second. But she's got a couple of, it was there a second ago. No.
Okay, you got it? All right. I'm a Wisconsin writer. What's the general consensus there with all of you wonderful people who save so many of us about how an untrained layperson acts when they are with someone or come upon a scene where a helmeted rider is needing the helmet removed for the reasons you just mentioned, vomiting, blocked airway? The hardest thing in the world would be to watch and wait and do something or nothing. Or should the untrained person just wait until somebody trained comes along? I just got to take it back to you. That's why we teach this class. And if you want me to tell you in 10 minutes all the things that you can do, I don't think I can do that. I think you're going to, what I would recommend you do is that you take a class so that you can learn how to do those right things. It's, the class is as much about what you should do as what you should not do. And, you know, sometimes it's about both of those, you know, eat both of those things. And, you know, I think too often the advice I've heard, which I believe is totally wrong, is that you should call 911 and do nothing, that you should not touch the person. As a matter of fact, it really makes me angry when I hear people advising groups of road captains, you know, and other folks, that they should not touch the person. That if something happens, they are to call 911, and that if they touch a person, that somehow they end up liable for that person's injuries because they touched them. That is so untrue.
Good Samaritan law.
Good Samaritan law covers you. Do you want to talk about Good Samaritan law, or you want me to do it?
Deb works for a local attorney. So.
This is Debbie Perinello. Actually, the Good Samaritan law varies from state to state, so it's best to check with your local state to see what your, you know, what your coverage is. But for the most part, the Good Samaritan law is if someone that is not being paid for their skills is helping someone out, they're considered a bystander. If, let's say, for example, you wouldn't want to do further harm, let's say, either. You wouldn't want to take someone that has an obvious fractured bone and start pulling them by their legs, things like that. So that would be one consideration. There are actually some, in Michigan anyway, a doctor, a paramedic, even a veterinarian.
It sounds like a joke.
No, it's not a joke. It is exempt from liability if they stop to help someone.
All right, well, that's cool. You know, most good Samaritan laws say something about gross negligence. And as long as you don't do something grossly negligent, and by the way, you are not responsible, unless you hit the person, I guess. You could be responsible for the person's injuries, but in, let's say you're stopping to help somebody. You just are driving by and you stop to help out. You are not responsible for the injuries that that person received when they had the crash. So I think a lot of times that thing that makes me so mad when they say the minute you touch that person, somehow you became liable for their injuries.
I mean, it's not true.
Can't you say the reverse also, that by just standing there and doing nothing, you're actually doing harm because you're not actually helping at all?
Most of the time, in most states, you are not required to assist. Now, in the state of Minnesota, you are required. You cannot drive by without doing something as minimal as making a phone call, but you are not welcome to ignore anything. But if you get to Illinois, then Illinois says, oh, you can only practice to your level of training. If you don't have any training, you really shouldn't intervene. So what Deb was talking about, that every state has its own Good Samaritan law, it's very true. And the piece of advice I tell people, because we love to travel, I think most motorcyclists go from state to state, and you need to have kind of a blanket understanding. And the blanket understanding is, don't accept compensation, number one. I helped somebody out in the Rocky Mountains last year with a pretty serious crash, and he called me up afterward, and he said, I want to make a donation. He says, I want to pay for some of your expenses for the trip that you were on, that you were there to help with as a medic. He said, who do I make the check out to? And I said, Accidency Management, because we're a 501c3. I was like, I cannot accept compensation. And once you do, it changes the tables. So as long as you do not accept compensation for helping somebody, and as long as what you do to help them is not something kind of crazy, like, for instance, like on TV, they show that you can use the jumper cables from your car to jumpstart somebody's car. And I got to tell you, that doesn't work. Don't do it.
Okay, in the state of Nevada, yeah, you just want to say, in the state of Nevada, the way it's worded is you're not to exceed your level of training. And as a bystander, you basically don't have a level of training. So if you do all the stuff that a bystander would do, short of a big pan tracheotomy, which was just demonstrated to me over there, which is what I always tell the class, you know, don't be afraid to get involved because you're covered. You came in with goodwill.
Sorry.
Interesting.
There's a lot of background noise.
Also, in the state of Nevada, okay, you're not required as a medically trained individual to stop at a wreck. You can just pass it by. And then there'd be that question of who would know anyway. But
yeah.
That's a question that comes up all the time in our classes as well. There's really no harm in involving yourself. And again, you know, everybody has a role, so do what you can.
Right. Whether it be putting a blanket on them or calling 911, do something.
So, you know, so Anne, to answer your question, to get back to your question, don't be afraid to touch the person and try to help them. More training is better. Like in Illinois, where I think that they still have some room for improvement with their Good Samaritan law, it says you can practice up to your level of training. So training is actually a really good thing. It lets you do more. And you should always be able to point back to why you did what you did. And training is a good way to be able to do that. Now, what are some of the other things that we teach that are special about our program? You know, what we teach in our first class that has gotten the nickname Basic, it's actually called a crash course for the motorcyclist, and we don't teach you how to crash. But so a lot of people think we teach people how to crash. But the things that we teach are, you know, right now this big summit is we are digging through things like the American Heart Association First Aid. We're digging through the International Trauma Life Support Program. We're looking at CERT training, Community Emergency Response Team. We're looking at ASHI, the American Safety Health Institute First Aid Program. We are looking at, you know, the Wilderness First Aid and what they teach. And we're pulling the best stuff that we can find out of each of those curriculums, the things in particular that really apply to us. Roadside trauma is a little different than your basic first aid. Like Alan was mentioning, basic first aid isn't enough. And if you learn CPR, great. If I have a heart attack out there on the road, I want you to know CPR. That would be a great thing. But if I crash my motorcycle, not so much, you know. Pumping on my chest and tipping my head back, I think that might not, you know, be a very good, you know, first response. So, yeah. So we really need people to understand what it is that we are facing, and we want you to be safe, too. So there's a lot of the safety factors for a motorcyclist that are covered in the program. And Trina, I'm going to hand this back to you because I'm going to have you talk a little bit about the safety aspects. And Terry Baum, then I'm going to have you talk a little bit about Hawaii because you really do have some Hawaii has its own culture. And she has found that there are some things that she needs to cover a little differently.
So safety as far as the accident scene itself, we want that when you walk up to the accident, that you don't become a victim also. So we teach people how to survey the scene as they walk up, make sure that no one else is going to become injured. And then once we look at the scene,
determine how many people are involved. Do we get the bikes moved? How many bikes we need to, you know, get out of the way, make room for EMS. Like I said, it's about your safety also as a rescuer, not just the victim's safety, because the last thing you want to do is have to ask for another helicopter or for another ambulance to come and pick somebody else who was injured in addition. So that's why we spend so much time on that accident safety part of the program, is because we want to ensure that you're safe and we don't have another.
No, before we get back to Cherry Bomb, I'm going to bring Bill back in. I've got Bill Black here on the phone. He's coming to greet us from, he's from New York. He's a paramedic, and he also has a lot of his background in EMS training and has worked on EMS curriculum and books. So, Bill, I'm going to have you say howdy to everybody.
Hello. How can everybody hear me?
We can hear you just fine. It's better when you talk, otherwise there's a lot of background noise. Go ahead and talk.
Okay, what do you want me to talk about? I'm sitting in Chicago.
How are your travels today? Are you doing okay getting here?
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of extra security because of the Paris incident. It took me almost an hour to get through security at LaGuardia. They're checking everything. And flight's okay. Now I'm sitting in Chicago O'Hare Airport for another hour or so before I catch my next connecting flight to go out to see you guys.
You're going to have a Chicago hot dog while you're there, aren't you? You got to find a Chicago hot dog.
No, no Chicago hot dog. New York has the best hot dogs. Just like New York has
I know
the best
you New
pizza,
Yorkers
too.
Think, yeah, I know you New Yorkers think you got a corner on those hot dogs.
Yeah, we do.
And
we have a corner on pizza.
Okay, pizza.
Yeah.
Oh, pizza. Yeah, that sounds good to me. So Bill, we're excited about seeing you later on tonight. We've got a lot of post-it notes all over the walls, so we're going to have your work cut out for you trying to figure out what it all means. But we'll catch you a little bit later. I'm glad you could call in.
Okay. Yep. I'll see you guys probably tomorrow morning.
Oh, okay. See you first thing in the morning. I'm making taco omelet. So be here by 9.
No problem. I mean, I don't get into Reno until 8, and I guess it's, about an hour flight, an hour drive down?
I know. You've got, hour and a half to the hotel. So,
and you guys
are... Yeah, we'll see you tomorrow morning. We're going to get your input on the military involvement as well and what the military is doing. So looking forward to our conversation.
Okay. Talk to you guys later.
Thanks. All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, so back to the group that's here. We've just got about 10 minutes or so left. And what I want to talk about yet as well is what are some of the differences that we see in different parts of the United States? And yes, the United States includes Hawaii and Alaska, and they can have some special needs, special things that we add to our program. So, Cherry Bomb, I want you to talk about that.
Well, hey, yes, definitely. Hawaii in and of itself, we are definitely a melting pot. And the writing community is just so tight. We're really a family. We're really an ohana. And there's no other way to put it. Everyone pretty much goes out of their way to help each other. But I will tell you that writing in Hawaii is pretty special. It's beautiful, but for the most part, unless you're shipping your bike in our island, it is an island. We are going around in circles. There's traffic. We find various creative ways to make the route.
New.
when basically you're either going clockwise or counterclockwise. and that's the truth of it. But anyway, what you're going to see is you're going to see cruisers, you're going to see cross rockets, you're going to see countless tourists on mopeds, you're going to see a ton of military that are required to wear full gear. And then you're going to see people wearing shorts and tank tops and slippers. same, we're all on the same road. And not all ouches are equal in that event.
And you, well, Jerry, uh-huh. Bob, you also, you know, you also have, like, you have a bigger view, too, because you're a trauma nurse, and you also do flight, like international flight.
Yes, I do.
So you really see a lot of different cultures. You see a lot of the ways that people respond. You also were there at the very first class that was taught in Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
and that's when you became an instructor in the first place. And one of the students who was there in that class, 1 week later, ended up using information to help all of them.
Most definitely. And what we talked about earlier about a good nearly half of students that take the class that very eerily end up using their training and coming back to us and letting us know.
I'm sorry. But you know what? Either way, if it turns out to be a necessary thing and better you had it than wish the training, that's why I just tell people straight up front. You know, you can stick your head in the sand or you can be glad you had the training and just be realistic about it and then to wish that you did. So please join us in one of our training classes that are nationwide.
What kind of animals do people hit in Hawaii?
not snake.
Not snake.
Technically.
What do we hit?
Little geckos and birds.
Oh,
well, actually, honestly, mongoose.
Okay.
Stray pets, unfortunately.
Oh.
Lots of potholes.
We have to go there.
Here you go, Vic.
Ellen.
We have cultural differences in the state of Nevada. We've got a large Hells Angels population. We've got the one percenters, the types that have their own protocols, their own club protocols, and we need to know things and we tell classes about how not to just rush in without any regard for the possibility of some form of club hierarchy and protocol and what might happen to you if you just try to walk around all that without having respect for it. We are aware of that. We, in workshops, we even pass that on to professional responders so that they can be aware of it. And there's ways to recognize those folks and ways to deal with them so that you don't offend.
And that's very true. It's just part of our culture. Now, we also have instructors, just so you know, that are not in the United States. Matter of fact, they're probably listening to this right now or sleeping. I'm not sure, because over in Australia, it's a different time altogether. It's like about 12 hours different. But we have instructors in Australia. We have instructors in New Zealand, the Philippines, which Cherry Bomb helped get going, and in South Africa. And they have some different needs, too, because, of course, they ride on a different side of the road. And believe it or not, there are a lot of cultures that don't ride together in packs as much as we do. It's not as common that they would get big groups riding together. The largest motorcycle club in Australia is called the Ulysses Group. And to be a full member of the Ulysses Group, you have to be 50 years old and older. And until you can be a member before you're 50 years old, but you're a junior member and you have no voting rights. So the Ulysses Group, though, you know, is very into safety. And the Ulysses Group, I did a special presentation for them a couple of years ago. But they, you know, they don't hit deer over there. They hit kangaroo, you know. So, and, yeah, they have wallabies. They have all kinds of, they have wallaby signs, you know. Look out for wallabies. So you'll have to look that up online if you want to know what a wallaby is.
From Arizona, but they were chasing after.
It got out of the zoo?
No, somebody had to put a head in as private ambulance, or private animal, sorry.
Private ambulance.
They got out of their cage and five wallabies were on the loose and
Oh, do they have big teeth?
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. Oh, okay.
Well, I couldn't remember.
Yeah. I really liked the koala bear. That was the... It was so... Yeah, but, yeah, they look hugy, but I understand they're not so hugy. So, you know, different parts of the United States are a little different. I have people down south that was telling me we don't have a riding season. You guys keep talking about this riding season that you have, but we don't have one, you know? You got California and... You know, so we find up north when it's cold that we've got a great opportunity to teach a lot of people. Their motorcyclists are jonesing to talk about motorcycles all day long. And so taking one of our classes is great because it kind of, you know, is a fix for them. And they can learn that stuff at the same time. So that's me asking her.
It's different. We teach our classes in the summer. So we are doing
the winter. Yeah. So in the summer is a better time for you because they'll ride there in the morning. They sit in the air-conditioned building all day, and then they can ride home when it cools off. So Arizona, do you find that in Texas too, Michelle?
Yeah.
I mean, our busiest times are when it gets colder because not everybody wanted to stay indoors, so we end up having classes that are cooler. During the summer, though, everybody's out and about. So for you, you don't have quite as much of a busier in the summer kind of thing, but it's still around year-round pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, there are some good times that you can actually ride almost year-round, but then we have the colder. There are a few months it can get really cold, so we just don't do it.
Yeah. So, you know, we find those little bit of cultural differences in the U.S., like we make a really big deal about hypothermia up north. And when people get to that slide down south, they're kind of like, you know, hypothermia, cold, what? Yeah, it was 65 degrees one day, and I was freezing, right, Sherry? I'm looking for a winter jacket, you know, with a wind chill and everything. It must have felt like 57, too. So, you know, we fight all of those things as well. You know, it's just, I told you this hour was going to go fast. It certainly has. Next week, I'm going to be talking to a gal that, her name is Karina Mantello, and she is with the Motorcycle Film Festival. You know how they have the Sundance Film Festival? Well, they started in New York, the Motorcycle Film Festival, and they've been reviewing things like that. One video, Why We Ride, that was the one that won the Motorcycle Film Festival like 2 years ago, something like that. And now this year, I think it was Dream Racer, but they go and they review all the motorcycle films. And I would love to go to that. It is open to general public, not terribly expensive, except for staying there. You know, getting to New York and staying there. But she's going to be talking to us a lot more about the festival that's become international and all the films that are being viewed and who won this year. So we'll be talking to her next week. We've always got these fascinating guests. The week after that is going to be Double D, as I had mentioned before. So we'll get him on the line. And, you know, we always on Tuesdays at 3 o'clock Central Standard Time, we want you to... Oh, I know, Michelle, this is her favorite song. She's a Jovi medic, by the way. So that's like your recital, her handle. And so you know this song, right? You know the words?
You're not going to hear me just sing
this song. Once you were silent, oh, yeah. So, you know, last parting thing to tell you about where, as far as what we're doing here, we are here to take care about y'all and we want to make a difference, but we can only do it if you take the classes. You're going to hear more about what comes out of this summit. You heard it first live here on the Inside Scoop by Christian. Hey.